Support for podcasting on KBIA comes from Grindstone Fitness Studio, a full-service gym offering equipment for traditional exercise like weight and cardiovascular training, as well as specialized classes. Choices include personal training, spinning, yoga, Pilates, and more. All classes taught by certified professionals. More information is available at 443-4447, Grindstone Fitness Studio, 3005 Chinaberry Drive in Columbia.
From the Missouri School of Journalism, welcome to Global Journalist. I'm David Reed. This weekend will mark the one-year anniversary of the massive earthquake and tsunami that hit coastal Japan. The wave of water, 40 to 60 feet high, erased coastal towns and killed more than 15,000 people. At least 340,000 people lost their homes. The tsunami also crippled the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear reactor and threatened to cause a nuclear catastrophe. Our guests for today's Global Journalist program are Martin Fackler, the Tokyo bureau chief for the New York Times, and James Acton, a nuclear policy expert for the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. They'll discuss what an independent report calls a disastrous response to the nuclear disaster. They'll discuss the scene 1 year later, along with the wider impact of this nuclear accident on the future use of nuclear power. Welcome to Global Journalist.
Pleased to be here.
Hello, David.
So to jog our memories a bit, we're going to play a 20-second clip from an NBC News broadcast the day after the flooding shut down the nuclear plant's cooling systems. The Fukushima 1 reactor exploded, which was caught on videotape and shown in this clip, a cloud billowing above the plant.
Of all the aftershocks, nothing frightened the world more than this: an explosion at the troubled Fukushima 1 nuclear power plant. The Japanese government had already declared an atomic emergency here yesterday when the cooling systems failed and radiation leaks were detected. Now there was a real fear of a meltdown.
Martin, tell us what was going through your mind when you heard about the explosion and the concerns about massive meltdowns.
Well, David, I was actually driving through Fukushima. So my first concern really was how far we needed to swing to the west from the plant to avoid actually getting caught in the radiation. So it was pretty scary because, you know, you can't see radiation, you can't smell it, you really don't have any idea how dangerous it is around you. So we really were, you know, we're on the ground there and we're just trying to get around it to get to the tsunami zones.
How would you assess the level of communication between the Japanese government and the citizens? And as you were sort of trying to piece this together as well in your reporting for the New York Times.
I think in the first months, actually, of the crisis, the Japanese government really did not inform its people very well as to the level of risk, the dangers involved. One of the most famous cases involves the Japanese government had this forecasting system that would predict where radiation spreads. It was called SPEEDY. And the SPEEDY computer system was turning out all sorts of predictions about where the radioactive plume from the accident would go, but the government did not disclose this to the public. And so you had cases where people were fleeing from the area around the plant, actually into where the plume was going, because they weren't getting the proper information. So you had, I think, a real an urge by the Japanese government, at least in the early weeks and maybe months of the accident, to play it down, and to play it down perhaps too much, and not really be forthright with their own people about the actual risks.
And so we know a lot more about what was happening behind the scenes, and you wrote an article recently about the investigation by the Rebuild Japan Initiative Foundation, and of course James works closely with that private policy organization. Martin, how could you briefly outline some of the most interesting points of this summary of this investigation that you learned about?
Well, I think the report really had two sort of interesting revelations, at least from my perspective. One was that it went into how different the sort of public face of the Japanese government was in terms of trying to reassure people that the accident was not so serious and that it was not so bad. And then the near panic that at times was that the government was going through in private. You know, even as it was telling people in Japan not to be alarmed, in private, it was drawing up worst-case scenarios that went so far as evacuating Tokyo. And so I think you get a sense of really how different the assessment was that they were giving themselves and how different, you know, that assessment was they're giving the public. The other really interesting thing coming out of the report was it reveals how precarious the U.S.-Japan relationship was in those first days. You know, of course, the U.S. and Japan have been military and political allies really since the end of World War II. And in many ways, you know, the U.S. and Japan did very well in terms of joint efforts to help victims of the tsunami, for example. But when it came to the nuclear plant, there was a real breakdown in communication.
Right.
And you had cases, for example, at one point the NRC recommended that American citizens evacuate from within 50 miles of the stricken plant at a time when Japan was recommending 12 miles.
Right.
Or had actually evacuated up to 12 miles. And so he had very different interpretations and very different public assessments of the risk. And I think what was going on, what the report shows us, is just the breakdown in communication. And it wasn't just Japan-America. It was, you know, the plant's operator, TEPCO, was not telling the government what was going on. The government wasn't telling the Americans. You know, it's just this complete breakdown in communication.
And how would
and
you
one of the,
go ahead?
Mm-hmm, I'm sorry. And say one of the upshots of that was a breakdown in trust. That you had a point where the U.S. government really wasn't trusting the Japanese government at all. And it took about 10, 11 days for them to fix that situation and kind of get things on a right keel.
Right. And how would you assess the Japanese media coverage of this event? Were they kind of just towing the government line, or were they skeptical?
In the beginning, I think that they really towed the government line. I think that they didn't talk about meltdowns at the plant really until mid-May, when the Japanese government finally admitted that there had been meltdowns there. And over time, they've gotten more and more skeptical, and then they've had some pretty good coverage of what went wrong. And, you know, recently they've been much more critical. But the first few months, I really think there was a sense of national crisis and that the media really needed to pull behind the government.
Right.
Kind of, you know, national unity and patriotism and this sort of thing.
And that's one of the problems with the report pointed out as well, that they wanted everybody to think nuclear power was completely safe.
Yeah, Japan had this thing that the Japanese now call the safety myth, and that was that Japanese technology, kind of the skills of the Japanese plant operators, and then also just science in general, had made these plants basically foolproof. And, you know, Japan's a very earthquake-prone nation, and it has built, I think, 54 commercial nuclear reactors, many of them atop fault lines. And it now basically has to figure out what it's going to do now that it's learned that these things actually can go wrong and that then that things can go disastrously wrong.
Right. One other thing that came out of the report, looking at the behind the scenes, the actions by the prime minister at the time, and also the TEPCO, the power plant operator, and the so-called Fukushima 50. Can you talk about these employees who stayed behind and risked their lives to basically save the plant?
Well, it was one of the real kind of few heroes to come out of this whole accident was a fellow named Masao Yoshida, and he was the plant manager at Fukushima Daiichi. And he became a folk hero in Japan because he disobeyed a direct order from corporate headquarters, from TEPCO's, you know, the plant operator's corporate headquarters, not to put seawater into the reactors to cool them. And the reason why the corporate headquarters said this was because once you put seawater into the reactors, at least my understanding is that basically ruins them. They can't be used again. And so corporate headquarters was still thinking about trying to save these things as commercial assets, whereas, you know, Mr. Yoshida recognized that basically they were way beyond that, that they really needed basically that, you know, they had to come up with some way to cool these reactors down. As you said earlier, they had, you know, the tsunami had knocked out the main cooling systems. And really the only option at that point was to inject seawater into the reactors. And so he disobeyed a direct order. He put seawater into the reactors, which ended up being the right thing to do in hindsight. And that conclusion made him a real hero here. And the Fukushima 50 refer to the plant workers who were there with him. And what happened was, you know, this is a large nuclear power plant. It has probably 3,000 employees or so. And most all of them were evacuated, especially as the situation began to get grim and you had the first explosion. And it kind of, there's this cascade of events, you know, that cascading series of events in the plant, and this, you know, the plant situation was really getting dire. And they evacuated most of the employees, but a small number, and it probably was more than 50, stayed behind, really basically putting their lives on the line to try to get this thing cooled, you know, these reactors cooled down, try to get the plant under control. And, you know, to their credit, they ultimately were successful.
Right. Now, you were, of course, there just after the tsunami hit, and you've also been back recently. Can you give us a bit of a before and after of the scene there around the plants and in that basic area? What it looked like when you first got there and what it looks like now?
Well, when I first got there after the tsunami and now are not a whole lot different. And the reason is that the tsunami came in. It basically wiped out. This is a coastal area with fairly flat coastal plains, and the tsunami probably went inland about 3 or 4 miles, and just took out everything. And if you go there today to these areas around the plant, that debris, you know, the beached fishing boats, the smashed homes, that's all basically still there. And the reason is they can't clean it up, and they can't clean it up because of the radiation. The whole area around the plant has been evacuated. Some 88,000 people have lost their homes. And it's a very eerie place. If you go there now, it's it really is a ghost town. And it's the parts that were destroyed by the tsunami are all still, you know, frozen in time from the moment of that disaster. The other parts are basically just ghost towns. And if you think of a Japanese rural town, many of the buildings are wooden. And what's happened over the last year is that without people to take care of them, the wood is rotted. And so you actually will see entire buildings are falling over into the street. Another odd thing you'll see is that while the people ran away, the farm animals were often left. And people had pigs, cows. They also had ostriches and animals like that. So right. You actually will drive through these towns and you'll see ostriches walking around or pigs walking around, cows walking around. And so it has this odd, almost sort of Jurassic Park-like feel to it.
Now, nobody died from the radiation, but what is the psychological impact that this caused on a country where two nuclear bombs were detonated in 1945.
Yeah, I think it's quite large because, you know, you mentioned Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and kind of one of sort of Japan's self-perceptions after the war was that, you know, it was a victim of nuclear attack that through its technological prowess and its scientific prowess was able to, in a sense, tame the atom, you know, tame this demon that had inflicted such pain upon them and turn it to peaceful, productive use. And now that sort of self-myth, if you will, has been proven not false, but it's certainly it's not as safe as, you know, atomic power is not as safe as they thought it was. But I think the biggest impact really involves distrust of government. I think that you know, as I said before, in the first months of the accident, the government was not very forthcoming and frankly not very honest in telling people the extent of the danger. And now people know that.
Right.
And so there's a real sense that the government lied to them. The government was dishonest with them. It looked down upon them. It was patronizing to them. And there's a real, I think there's a real deep, you know, distrust in government and a feeling that, you know, the elites who've run Japan since World War II, the bureaucrats and these sort of, these politicians and whatnot, are that really sort of respect for them and trust for them is at a real low now. Where that goes, I don't know.
Okay.
I mean, it's still something that's in mid. You know, that's a trajectory that's still in midair. But I really think there's a new sort of skepticism in government and in kind of these technocrats, you know, who ran Japan for so many decades.
Right. Okay, so before we continue our discussion and talk with James more about the impact of this disaster on nuclear power and where it goes from here, I want to remind everyone that you can view or listen to this program anytime by downloading our podcasts at globaljournalist.org. You also can find interesting articles, photos, and interviews related to today's program on our website. So please send us comments or questions via globaljournalist@kbia.org or our Facebook page. So James, I wanted to ask you about, again, your thoughts at the time of this, the explosion and when we had the fears of meltdown came. And you were in a chat session and interviewed during this NBC broadcast. And you were asked about the worst-case scenario. What did you tell people at that point?
Well, on the early hours of the 11th, this is in the U.S. time, when the news of the earthquake and the tsunami started to filter through, it was clear there was a nuclear element to this crisis. And on that Friday, we didn't really know how serious the nuclear crisis was. And obviously, the fact you had a nuclear power plant caught up with all of this was pretty serious. But it was when we found out about the explosion on the 12th that we really knew that this was a major nuclear accident. I mean, you don't get a hydrogen explosion unless there's been fuel melting, and that's the very definition of a serious accident. So, you know, when that had happened, that was then when you started talking through the worst-case scenarios.
Right. Now, in retrospect, was this preventable?
Was absolutely preventable. The risks that tsunamis pose to power plants are very well understood, and the ways of mitigating those risks are very well understood. The problem was that Japan didn't follow international standards and international best practices in terms of mitigating the tsunami risk. And Martin was absolutely right. There was a belief in Japan that a nuclear accident, a major nuclear accident, was simply impossible. And if you go from that perspective, then you don't take safety seriously. Had Japan followed international standards and international best practice, then I'm pretty confident this accident would never have happened.
Besides the preparing better for a wave of this size that had happened from the report, the summary of the report I read, there was a tsunami of this size about 1,500 years ago. And there was warnings just a few days before the accident that there could be a large tsunami. Besides that, what were some other international best practices that were not followed?
Let me just talk briefly first about the warnings a few days before the tsunami, because this is connected with this historic earthquake and tsunami in the year 869 AD, which is known as the Jogen event. And in 2008, TEPCO, that's the Tokyo Electric Power Company, the plant's owner-operator, had done some new tsunami simulations, and that had assumed a repeat of this earthquake from 869. Which was a bigger earthquake than their previous simulations had been based on. And they did some preliminary modeling in late 2008, which suggested that the plant had been could be inundated by a much bigger tsunami than previously expected. But unfortunately, that wasn't followed up. And in a kind of tragic, ironic twist of fate, it was actually only reported through NISA, which is the Japanese regulator, the Nuclear and Industrial Safety Agency, on the 7th of March 2011, so just 4 days before the accident. You also asked about other ways in which Japan didn't follow international standards and international best practices. I mean, just very briefly, two or three. The regulator, NISA, was generally very inattentive to tsunami risks. There are design features of plants elsewhere in the world that, had they been present in the Japanese plant at Fukushima Daiichi, then they would have prevented a major accident, even if you'd failed to predict the possibility of the plant being inundated by a massive tsunami. So there were a whole series of failings in the Japanese approach to safety.
Right. I was reading this summary of the an NPR Frontline documentary about this, and they talked about, again, the Fukushima workers who stayed behind and the improvising they had to do because they had no guide for what to do in this kind of a situation. And I thought it's pretty dramatic that they went out to outside of the plant and ripped car batteries out of their cars in order to bring some of the instrumentation of the plant back to life. And then they discovered that the pressure of the reactor was out of control, and they were trying to figure out a way to vent it. Sounds extraordinary. What are your thoughts about what was happening in that plant?
Well, those early hours, immediately after the accident, the plant operators really did have to improvise. You see, all of the AC power sources, both the connection to the grid and the internal emergency diesel generators installed within the plant were lost, so there was no AC power. But also in two of the units, in units 1 and 3, the emergency DC batteries, which had about an 8-hour design life, were swamped and were destroyed by the tsunami. So there was no power, DC power, two of the units, and so all the instrumentation was lost. And yeah, you know, the plant operators had to go and find cabling that was sitting around the plant, use car batteries in order to get some kind of instrumentation up and running, so they had some idea what was going on. And if you read the report, the conditions that the plant workers faced in those early hours were really horrendous. You know, the site had been inundated. There was lots of water everywhere. There was thick mud. There was debris that the tsunami had scattered all over the plant. Manhole covers were missing, so there was a danger of falling into holes in the ground, which they couldn't see because it was dark, obviously, at night. And there was no electricity. So these were really dangerous, hazardous conditions. In which plant operators, I think, behaved incredibly bravely.
Right. Let's now talk about the lessons and then look a little bit forward. What are some of the lessons we learned from this accident that hopefully are being implemented in countries with nuclear power?
Well, for me, the absolutely fundamental lesson is you never take your eye off the ball of nuclear safety. As I mentioned before, the risks of tsunamis and other hazards ranging from terrorism to extreme weather effects brought about by climate change are actually pretty well understood, and international standards and best practices have been developed in order to mitigate those risks. But, you know, those standards just exist on paper unless states actually implement them. And for me, the fundamental lesson, and I say this as a supporter of nuclear power, an accident is always possible. And unless you accept it's possible, you're not going to take the steps to reduce the probability as much as possible. There's very important lessons about emergency response and accident management. You know, the official report that the executive branch of the Japanese government commissioned has been a little bit critical of plant operators for not acting perfectly. But the truth is, if you have an accident management plan that requires people to act perfectly, you don't have an accident management plan. So developing realistic accident management plans, developing good communication plans in advance, this is something it's impossible to improvise at when you're doing it. And also there's key lessons about regulation, about the need to have an independent, a about the need to have a regulator that's independent from both government and industry and is strong enough to enforce its decisions.
And has that happened in Japan? Have they changed the system?
Well, Japan is going through a whole process of regulatory reform at the moment. The problems with the Japanese approach to safety were pretty deep, and it's going to take longer than a year to fix them. I visited a plant at Tokai, which is 100 or 150 kilometers south of Fukushima, in August. And they're doing a huge amount of engineering work and preparing for accident management there, and I was pretty impressed by that. And the process of regulatory reform is ongoing right now. I don't think we yet know exactly what form the new regulator is going to take and whether it's going to solve all of the problems of the previous one.
Okay, we have about a minute and a half left. I wanted to talk a bit about the impact of this near catastrophe on the future of atomic power in Japan and the United States and elsewhere. What's going to happen?
The effect will be felt differently in different countries. There was lots of talk about, before the act, of a nuclear renaissance in the U.S., but that was unlikely to happen simply because of the cost of building new plants in the U.S. In other countries, particularly India and China, their ambitious plans to continue with nuclear energy have been put on hold, but they're almost certainly going to restart them and build lots of new reactors. Western Europe, with the exception of the UK, has kind of been very much turned off nuclear energy. And I think in Japan, the future of nuclear energy is actually really unclear right now.
Okay. Well, James, we've come to the end of this week's edition of Global Journalist, produced by the Reynolds Journalism Institute and the Missouri School of Journalism. Joining us today were Martin Fackler, Tokyo Bureau Chief for the New York Times, and James Acton, a nuclear policy expert for the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Thank you so much, James and Martin, for being on our program. It's very enlightening. Global Journalist is directed by Travis McMillan, audio by Pat Akers. Raymond Tungekar is our executive producer. Sravani Pair was our lead producer, assisted by Alexander Baumhart and Jay Kwan. Now stay with us for Free Press Watch, and join us again next week for another Global Journalist. I'm David Reed.
And now, Free Press Watch, a segment on Global Journalist where each week we bring you a rundown of major events affecting press freedom around the world. I'm Lainey Mullen. Today's news comes from the Committee to Protect Journalists, Reporters Without Borders, and Reuters. In Haiti this week, the manager of a radio station in Port-au-Prince was shot and killed. Jean Nelson was known for his committed coverage of the poor neighborhood of Cité Soleil on Radio Boukman, which he helped to found almost 6 years ago. In Tajikistan, authorities blocked four news sites and Facebook. Three of the sites had published critical information about the country's longtime president, Emomali Rahmon, and related news was posted on Facebook. As of last year, 26,000 people in Tajikistan used the social networking site. In India, citizens attacked a group of about 100 journalists in the northern state of Uttar Pradesh. The crowds rioted over election results, which the journalists were covering. Police did little to help, and the journalists had to lock themselves in a school for protection. Only equipment was damaged. For more information on these and other events affecting press freedom around the world, please visit our website at globaljournalist.org. Thank you for joining us this week on Global Journalist. I'm Lainey Mullen. See you next week.